Now, I suppose you all know how ordinary television works.
You photograph something.
Sure, I do. You photograph something, then the photograph is split up into millions of tiny pieces, and they go whizzing through the air down to your TV set where they're all put together again in the right order.
You should open your mouth a little wider when you speak.
Love to watch TV, Mike?
You bet.
You like the killings, huh?
What do you think life's all about?
So we're back after just a brief hiatus, and let's talk about, other than Preacher, what we've been watching. Dean, kick it off.
If you're not watching The Righteous Gemstones, get on it on HBO. Dan McBride's new show starring him, John Goodman, and Adam Devine as a father and son, trio of evangelist preachers in the South. Just fantastic, hilarious, another so hit for McBride.
Absolutely. And your favorite biker gang soap opera is back. That's right, Mayans on FX. It is a Sons of Anarchy sequel. I'm a huge Sons of Anarchy fan. I loved the first season of Mayans. It maybe started first couple of episodes a little slow, but it picked up. I would say it's as good as Sons, maybe not quite as good, but it is still really, really good. Mayans is just a fun, fun show on FX. Glad to see it back.
Ballers, also on HBO, it's in its final season, or its final season is about to start here this fall. So I've been catching up with The Rock and Rob Corddry to see how their escapades of being sports agents plays out on TV.
And I'm going to keep saying it because I just can't get enough Succession. If anybody has thought about maybe just dipping a toe into Succession, come on to season 2. I think it's episode 4. It's called Panic Room. It might be episode 3 now. I can't remember. It's the latest episode. Just watch that episode as a standalone episode. You might not get all of the context, but you'll get enough. And it may make you want to go back and watch all of the show. I absolutely love it.
Phase 2 is in place and awaits your command. Any sign of Custer?
Not yet. Eager for your revenge, Klaus? You wanted to cut
carve a vagina into Custer's head. That's right. Delightful piece of sadistic irony. And my reward as well. My looks. My beauty fully restored.
Right.
It's just that physical attractiveness has always been sort of a calling card for me.
And you'll have it, God willing. How is the Christ child?
All right, so here we are. This is Mike TV, episode 16, in which we will be covering Preacher, which is on AMC, now airing in its 4th and final season. We're going to cover episode 5, called Bleak City, and episode 6, entitled The Lost Apostle. Welcome, Dean. My name is Lisa. Welcome, Dean, my co-host. How are you? We've had a little bit of a hiatus. We're back.
Yeah, it's been a busy couple of weeks, but hopefully we can get back on the saddle this week and get back on track.
Yes. Everybody's okay from the hurricane?
Yeah, my parents had to come up last week, but, you know, thankfully they realized it wasn't going to hit Alabama, so they went back to where they lived. they came up from Florida, but yeah. All good. So they're out.
Well, thanks to everybody who came out to the live show, the Radio Labyrinth live show on Friday, August 30th. That was so much fun. Appreciate the folks that came up and said they were listening to Mike TV. We love y'all. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Shout out to Fooksie. Fooksie was there. He's listening. He's enjoying our Preacher coverage. So we appreciate that, Fooksie. He gave me a really cool button. Now added to my collection. So thank you, Fooksie. It was great to see you and great to see everybody. It was a lot of fun, Dean. Hope you're going to be at the next one.
Hopefully I don't have to work. I'll be there if I can, especially if they get it back to my man Mike Hall's establishment in Conyers, Pizza and Euro, Atlanta Pizza and Euro. Hit that place up if you're in the Conyers area.
Definitely. Yeah, he was there. Shout out to Mike Hall. Absolutely. All right. So we're going to cover two episodes again. We'll see if we can get this tight and succinct. There's a lot to cover. I'm enjoying Preacher. Are you enjoying it? We're at the halfway yes. point.
You know, my feelings on Preacher, it's for me, this is just a fun ride. I don't try to dip too deep into overthinking about it. I just enjoy it and laugh and enjoy the action in it. It's just an awesome action comedy.
Well, I'm definitely enjoying it. I've rewatched both these episodes that we're going to cover. I actually watched episode 6 3 times and find myself enjoying it more and more upon rewatch, which I think is a sign of good writing and good acting and good overall show. So I do want to make a correction. I think I've been saying up to this point that I thought there were 9 episodes this season, but I do see now on my TV Time app that there are in fact 10 episodes this season. So we have 4 to go as we record this episode. I don't want to see it end. Of course, I'm not as heartbroken and forlorn as I am with this show, like I was with Legion. But as I start to see this countdown, I do see now where I think the show is on full steam ahead. I think it left us at that point. And I would like for us, Dean, to not say them now, but let's save them till the end of the episode. People who want to skip ahead can just go ahead and skip ahead. But let's make some predictions at the end of this episode about what we think is going to happen.
Well, you're going to cheat because you've already read all the books. So,
well, I'm not going to cheat because what I do know is that I believe that they're planning to change the end.
Okay.
So I can only speculate. I actually don't think they're going to end it the way the comic ended.
Okay.
So which I'm pleased with. My husband, not so much, but I'm pleased with that decision. So, okay. Any more overall thoughts about these two episodes before we dive in?
We've already kind of said it, but I do week after week with Preacher, especially. I know we love The Boys and The Boys, another Garth Ennis property, which is another one that's also put together by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. But Preacher is just week in and week out. I actually think I enjoy it more than The Boys. Their combination of, like I said, action, almost a slapstick style comedy at times, the buddy-buddy relationships between Preacher and Cassidy, the weird relationships that, you know, different characters you don't expect to be put together with, like Eugene and the Saint of Killers, all these different groups. Now we have Hitler and Jesus that are kind of in a situation together, Air Star and God, just these weird quirky combinations of people, and they all work. So yeah. Just everything about the show is, like I said, don't get too deep into it. Don't get offended by the silliness of it. Just enjoy this for what it is, a fantastic telling with a lot of action, a lot of funny lines, some heart there, you know, in the middle of it too. It's just, I like it. It's great.
Yeah. And these two episodes did not fail to deliver on all of those points.
No.
Lots of humor, but lots of really good heartfelt moments too. So we'll definitely talk about those because I think there were some standout performances in both of these episodes. All right, so let's dive in. Episode 5, we'll do a quick scene-by-scene walkthrough of both. You, Dean, you just jump in when there are moments that you want to expound upon. I'll kind of talk about scene-by-scene, and we'll just dive into any thoughts. But if there's not anything more to say about them, we'll just keep going.
Good deal, Charles.
So episode 5 was called Bleak City. Interesting title for that episode. It was kind of a bleak episode. I didn't find any specific things that relate it back to that specific title, but that's fine. It opens with an Australia montage. We've seen, you know, these kinds of scenes from Australia before, letting us know that we're in Australia. The funny thing was, I guess this is something that the editors find funny, is that every third or fourth scene was real brutal shots of rugby and kind of grunts and groans. So I didn't really take a lot of takeaways from that. But anyway, we know we're in Australia. Eugene and the Saint are at a Melbourne tourist information shop, and there's a bunch of dead people all around them, and Eugene is saying prayers over them, and he's asking the saint if they're going to just wait for Jesse to use his powers again. So we know that the saint has been tracking, you know, every time Jesse uses his powers. Meanwhile, Jesse is at a car rental place, and the man working the counter is named Jackson, with an interesting spelling of Jackson that we see on his tag. And he also stutters, and he's pulling up Jesse's information in the computer as Jesse's attempting to rent a car. And it comes up on the monitor that Jesse's a wanted man. And Jesse can see that too on the monitor. And what was really interesting here is that without using the word, he convinces Jackson to rent him a car using of his own free will. So he just uses his incredible power of persuasion. I really loved that scene. But then as Jesse leaves, he does use the word to take away Jackson's stutter. And I really liked that too. But my question here is, does Jesse know each time he's using the word that the saint is able to track him? Did we discuss this yet?
Don't think he figured that out. No, it seems like he doesn't figure that out, and or if he does know it, he just doesn't ever consider it, because he always uses the word when he seems like he's way far away, mm-hmm. and yet it brings the Saint of Killers to him every time.
Did he have that realization or that understanding in earlier seasons? I just can't remember.
I don't remember. Because I almost forgot about it until, I think, last episode, when you realize he's tracking him using the word again. Because when they sit there, even in this one, they're sitting there and he's asking, so you just sit and wait and listen for
Yeah, him? Yeah. So I'm going to try to go back and find the answer to that and try to have it for next week. So there's a funny bit where Jesse's getting into his rental car in the parking deck and he gets in on the wrong side. That was funny. He starts flipping through the radio dial. Of course, I'm saying wrong side because we're in the United States and we drive on the left side of the car, and in Australia they drive on the right side. I'm not saying it's wrong, so pardon me if I go that down that road.
No, it's okay. Australia is a backwards country. So.
But that was a funny bit. Anyway, so then Jesse's flipping through the radio dial in the car, and just broadcast after broadcast, it's just these little bits about this wanted man, this preacher that's, you know, on the loose. And so that was funny too. And then there's a very long and anticlimactic drive through the parking deck. Felt a little fillerish. I didn't really understand why they took so long for him driving through the parking deck, except it does end with Jesse stopping short while he's exiting the parking deck when he doesn't see an oncoming car. And I don't know if this is, again, because this happens to him again later on in the episode too, and I don't know if that's, again, a reference to the roads and he's not looking both ways at a one-way road because the traffic is a different direction than he's accustomed to. I'm not sure. Anyway, as he exits the parking deck, he sees Eugene standing on the corner. Eugene sees him and screams, "Go!" And then Jesse sees the saint rounding the corner and drives off and just makes it around the corner just before the saint has time to fire off some of his magic bullets. And on his way, speeding out of town, of course, Jesse has a change of conscience and realizes he has to go back for Eugene. So what'd you think of any of these opening scenes with Jesse renting the car and seeing Eugene and the saint?
I think they kind of slow play it just to build some tension, because you keep waiting for almost a bullet to fly in and hit Jesse or something. And so maybe that's kind of the fillerish part where he's driving through the deck. But I do like that, at least for now, it seems Eugene's looking out for the preacher.
Yes, for now. We'll come to that for sure. So here was a wonderful moment, however. Tulip and Cassidy have reunited at the Holy Grail and Bar. So this is where Cassidy escapes Masada. And where does he hide out? The Holy Grail and Bar, of course. And his disguise is just to, you know, bleach his hair and wear a Forgive me, I don't know what those pieces of clothing that the men wear. But he's wearing one of the, like a burqa or something, right? Is that correct? Is that what they're called?
No.
I know. All right, I'm sorry. So they're sitting at the bar, Tulip and Cassidy, and they're exchanging stories. You know, they haven't really sat down together and been together in a very long time. So I do love we get the tail end of some of their stories where Cassidy is summarizing the story and ending up the story with Icarus. And then, you know, but then he says, but of course, that's nothing compared to fighting Nazis on a bus ride to hell, meaning, you know, Tulip had already told her story. So I did love that conversation between them. And another funny bit is Jesus is sitting in the corner playing Asteroids. So hilarious. And the angel, now he's looking a little coiffed now. He's got his hair all shiny and mohawked, but this is the angel that freed Cassidy from the prison in Masada. He walks up and introduces himself as Effendi. And I do love that his name is Effendi. It's very perfect, very apt.
Yeah, I like this kind of, you know, it's starting to lead back toward the opening scene of the whole season, you know, with the kiss between Tulip and Cassidy. So we're already kind of seeing that relationship budding. And yeah, Jesus just hanging out, almost seemingly like he's finally getting to enjoy his time away from being his godly duties, playing the Asteroids and later on hanging out with Tulip is great.
Tulip and Cassidy are continuing to talk, and Tulip does ask Cassidy if he told Jesse that that they slept together, and she says, oh, I won't be mad. And of course Cassidy does confess that yes, he did tell him, to which Tulip replies by punching him in the face. And on the TV behind the bar, there's a broadcast about standing outside of Jesus Desaad's place. And the broadcast is about a holy man who came in and desecrated a sex tourist palace. So I thought that was a funny little touch too, that they added that in. Any more thoughts about this opening scene with Tulip and Cassidy before we move on?
No, like I said, I just keep waiting to get caught up where we started at the season, and it seems we're getting closer and closer to that.
I think we're going to be totally there by episode 7.
Right.
We'll get to that for sure. Okay, so another funny bit, a Grail chambermaid discovers that Jesus has pulled the old switcheroo. When she goes to serve him breakfast and he's not in his bed, she goes to wake him up. Instead, there's just some pillows there. That was so funny that's how he
that's one of those little things where it was completely unnecessary, but it's just so almost childlike thinking on Jesus's part, or just even the thought of putting that into this show of just, yeah, yes, the pillows. That'll fool this right. Giant compound.
Then we cut to Featherstone standing before Hairstar saying she's ready to die. She's failed in her duties. She's allowed a prisoner to escape. She knows that she has to die. And he's holding a gun and about to execute her, and the phone rings. And of course, on the phone, Hairstar is learning that Jesus has gone missing. So he's freaking out. He can't focus on the job at hand, so he tells Hoover 2 to carry out the execution. And Featherstone doesn't like this. She, you know, she demands that for her service and, you know, over the years, that the execution ought to be carried out by Star himself. She deserves that much at least. But Star, of course, is paying her no mind. And as Hoover 2 is just about to carry out the execution, we see her jump through the window and once again take off in her amazing wingsuit, you know, that she flew off with before. So I liked the callback to that. Then we see Hitler playing racquetball or squash, or maybe probably squash, with an old lady. This was another scene that was just comic relief. It was not needed, but So they're playing squash, and Hairstar storms in and he grabs the lady's racket, pushes her down. It was so funny. And he just starts beating the crap out of Hitler. And, you know, he's angry, I guess, that Jesus has gone missing. Somehow he's taking this out on Hitler. But he also seems to know that Hitler has seen the Messiah. You know, the quote.
I think that's what he was more pissed about. I got that's what he was really mad about, because he was more mad at Featherstone for Jesus leaving. But yeah, he was more mad that he found out Hitler snuck in and tried to play the soft shoe and for Humperdoo.
Right.
Which that's still not the right Humperdoo, right? Like, it's still a, right. Yeah.
Right. But Hitler seems to be fooled by him, or else the beating made him submissive enough to admit that, that's the Messiah. Yeah,
that's what I think. Cause we ended when we saw that scene in the last episode, he just sits down to start to play the piano. Right. So I'm assuming he's found out that this is not the real Messiah. And so, yeah, this is Aristar's way of basically, you better keep your mouth shut type of thing.
Or it's Hitler's ignorance. He really doesn't. He doesn't know what to expect. Maybe he does. The world has yet to see the unveiling of the real Humperdoo's soft shoe skills. So
I think you're shortchanging Hitler.
I don't know. I don't think Hitler is really the real mind control in the powerhouse here in this show. Anyway, it was funny to see him getting his ass beat by Hairstar. Then we move into one of my favorite scenes, which is the construction site. So it was just very smart. You know, you can tell this was a low-budge scene, but that taking like what would be a high dollar, high budget scene, in other words, and they've made that, you know, they probably had nobody even behind the fence. They have this, so let me, you know what I'm saying. They have this big fence. I'm trying to paint the picture for people listening. Hopefully you've seen the episode. You know what I'm talking about. Jesse's walking by a big construction fence, like a privacy fence. And there's just little small windows and gaps in the fence. That kind of let you peer in and see that there is construction going on in there, and you hear construction noises, but you never really see the actual construction. Anyway, he finds a broken panel in the fence and walks in and immediately uses the word to get everybody under his control there. To which, this is why I think Jesse does know the saint knows when he uses the word, that the saint can track him, because he goes in, immediately uses the word, and then it's almost like he's lying in wait for the saint to come to him, right? He's setting a trap.
Yeah, you're right. He does pretty much set the trap there, yeah.
So anyway, he uses the word, and it cuts to the saint, whose ears perk up. He knows where Jesse is now. He and the saint quickly end up at that same construction site. And all we see is just from this amazing shot through the window as the saint and Eugene are walking by through the window in the fence, I should say, is just this big, it's like the big ball and crane ball comes swooping down and just pulverizes the saint. It was amazing. And of course, it doesn't kill him, but it does slow him down long enough for Jesse to be able to escape with Eugene. What did you think of the scene?
This was definitely one of my favorite shot scenes. As soon as I saw the fence, I was hoping we wouldn't see what happens behind it. I like just that you're getting, because they always show us so much action sometimes. You think of the hallway at the DeSada mansion, that fight where you see so much action. And this one, it's leaving your imagination of what's going on. But the way they shoot that, little, you know, snippets here and there from the holes in the fence. Really cool way to shoot that shot.
And that crane coming down, I mean, that just came out of nowhere. And, you know, all of a sudden it happened so fast. And then the saint is just off, you know, off screen, presumably smushed.
Right.
It was very well done. Smart, smart direction and editing there.
The saint of killers always makes me think of, like, old Looney Tunes, like Wile E. Coyote type of thing, where he just get, you know, the thought that he's getting hit with this giant wrecking ball, and it just, and shows him kind of just dusty later on, you know, like he's never actually hurt by anything. He just kind of, you know, I would expect if he got blown up by a bomb, he would just have soot all over his face. Right. And he'd have the little singe on his hair, but that would be it.
Well, remember last season, speaking of the Nazi fight on the bus ride to hell, you know, he is pulverized by that tank, torn in half, if I'm not mistaken, by that tank, and is still able to literally pull himself together and keep fighting. So, yeah, I mean, that ball just slowed him down just for a little bit, just a scratch. Okay, so meanwhile, back at the Holy Grail and bar, Cassidy is trying to convince Tulip that they need to go to Australia and help Jesse. Tulip says she's not going. She's clearly angry at Jesse. She tells Cassidy she's going to take Jesus to Las Vegas. She's trying to convince Cassidy to come with them. And then she leaves to go fix her car. And as she's in the garage fixing her car, she tells Jesus that once they're off, there's no turning back. This is where we start to see the first sign of hesitation in Jesus. He says, oh, yeah, there is this conference he's supposed to attend, but no, he'd rather go on this trip with her. So more to come on that. Meanwhile, back at the bar, Effendi is anxiously awaiting for his hot date to arrive. He is extremely horny, extremely thirsty. He tells Cassidy that forbidden love is the best kind of love. Cassidy gets angry, tells him to stop. He sees what he's trying to do, and can't Effendi see? He's trying to do the right thing here. And Effendi says, you're right. Who am I to give advice about love? Look where it got me, cast out of heaven, exiled, and imprisoned. So that line right there was all we needed, and we'll come back to this in just a second, but it's all we needed to know that that was the reason why he was in prison. What's about to happen here is why he was in that cell in Masada to begin with. And then she arrives. Then there's this beautiful dance number. I really loved this dance number. It breaks out and they start, it's like this ballroom dancing moment to Love of My Life by Queen. And I even thought for a minute, and I even said to Sean, I was like, oh, I bet Dean is loving this because it made me think of Legion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love Cassidy just in the bartender kind of just sitting there nonplussed by it all. Just
yes. The dance number ends, and we see her demon tail pop out and wrap around him, and his wings come out and wrap around her. It was very beautiful. So at this point, and definitely, I think it's confirmed. Well, I guess it's really not confirmed in this episode, but at this point, I was feeling assured that we were seeing Genesis's parents here. Did you get any sign of that? Or am I spoiling it?
No, but in the show, has it ever really been explained what the power is? I don't remember at what point they actually say that Genesis is a like an entity as opposed to just the power of God.
Yes, it's in the first season when Fior and DeBlanc are trying to take it away from Jesse. Correct. And Jesse demands an explanation, and they're the ones who explain that this Genesis is his name. He was born from the forbidden love of an angel and a demon.
Okay.
And it never really, they never expound beyond that. Like, oh, the demon was exiled and the angel was sent into a, you know, a deep prison well. You know, they never say that, but I am 100% sure this is what we're seeing here.
So does Genesis have like a corporal body? Like, do we ever actually see, or I mean, you can kind of spoil from the comic arc, but like, is there actually ever a Genesis character, or is it just this power?
In the comic book, it's always just kind of shown as this bolt of light. Sometimes you see a face in it or something, but no, I don't remember it ever being corporal.
Does it have a consciousness, or does it have any control over itself?
Yes, it gets to choose the host it wants. It's choosing, or he, or it, I guess it is choosing to live in Jesse. See, what happened was it was an abomination. It was born right. from an angel and a demon. So it was an abomination and it was supposed to be destroyed. But instead it was, you know,
right.
being kept under wraps by a few in heaven who knew of it, like Fior and DeBlanc. They were kind of the agents of keeping this thing at bay and keeping it under control. So then when it escaped heaven, that's when they lost control.
But even inside of Jesse, it's not like a Farouk David situation where it's controlling right. or pulling any control over Jesse. Jesse has just use of it.
Mm-hmm. Correct. It's just okay. It just wants to not be killed, I think, mostly.
Okay.
I think, well, you know what? I hope we get some answers on that. I can't remember exactly the answers the comic book gave. But okay. I feel, yeah, those are good questions. I feel like we're going to get some answers there. All right.
All right.
Anything else about Effendi and this beautiful dance number before we move on?
It's great. And then what happens next with them? And then next after the again, two kind of randomly seeming people that pop up in the show, but just what happens with them over the next, you know, time period of the next two episodes is just awesome. Awesome.
It is awesome. So next we see Jesse and Eugene in the car together. He's still got his rental car, and this is where Jesse gives Eugene the extremely heartfelt apology. And remember, this is what Eugene said he wanted from him. And it brings tears to Eugene's eyes. And he is again with that childlike behavior of his saying, "You apologized." You know, he's just kind of awed by it. But this was just some really great acting by both of these gentlemen here. Dominic Cooper, the things he says, it was very, very moving. I don't have it verbatim, but, you know, it was, you know, it's probably the best apology anybody could ever hope for, right? I mean, when somebody right, says those things to you, how can you not forgive them? It was heartfelt. It was sincere. He meant it. It was obvious he meant it. He felt genuinely bad for sending Eugene to hell.
Yeah, and I think Eugene really represents, and Jesse seems to realize this during this little speech, that Eugene does represent the unintended consequences of the Genesis power. Mm-hmm. You know, like we've saw in the last couple episodes with all these random people getting killed that he doesn't mean to hurt, but Eugene really was the first time he accidentally hurt somebody with it. And I think he was running from that. And he even says he was afraid I didn't know I could help you. I was afraid. So I think it was him kind of coming to terms with that.
Right. I liked the real honesty in their conversation, and you hit upon it. And I wanted to expand that, because when he does say, "Why didn't you come get me?" And Jesse says, "I didn't know I could." That's true. I wish, however, Jesse had also said, "But then the power was taken from me, and I spent many months without it, and there was nothing I could have done anyway." You know, like, I wish he had at least said, "It's not like I just left you down there. It was beyond my control for a large part of it."
Right.
And also, how was he supposed to know that he could just follow him to hell and get him out? He didn't know. He doesn't know all the extent of this power. So this is me saying that Eugene should have accepted this apology at this point. This is what he wanted, right?
I think you're just not being fair to poor Eugene. Dude had to spend all that time in hell. He had to become friends and then not friends with Hitler. He's being drug around by this crazy demon cowboy.
What an adventure he's Ian had. Coletti,
yeah, Ian Coletti's a fantastic actor, to be able to have that prosthetic on your face.
And oh, yeah. Still
this emotion with mainly his eyes and the way that he does kind of mumble out the words. He's very underrated, I think, mm-hmm. in this show.
I was looking for sound clips to put into this, you know, to put in post into this episode. And really, for an audio medium, I can't put any clips in with Eugene, because you can't, without the subtitles, you really can't understand what he's saying.
"You could just be preacher, and just a preacher. Hey, preacher."
That's about what it's really incredible what he's doing here. All right. Moving on. Jesus and Tulip are out in the car waiting, hoping that, you know, Cassidy's going to come out of the bar and join them. Of course, Tulip, being her stubborn self, refuses to go in and get Cassidy. She's just waiting for him to make up his mind. But they are out there smoking a joint, and Jesus is, it's funny, again, we come in on the tail end of this conversation as the camera moves in on them smoking this joint, and Jesus is lamenting about how just that one sin that he did changed everything. And then he goes, well, I guess actually it was two sins because she was married. So, well, you know, of course this is what led to, you know, the lineage of that now has brought us Humperdew. But I did think that that was funny. Jesus kind of rationalizing with it like a human would, right? Then Jesus says that the new Messiah is the correct one. And, you know, he is God's favorite after all, this new Messiah. And then Tulip is shocked, and she's like, Humperdew? She just can't believe it. She tries to tell Jesus that God is an asshole, but he's not really listening to that. And then meanwhile, back in the bar, here's the moment that you were speaking of. We don't really see it, but we sure do hear it. And that is Effendi and the demon are having crazy, crazy sex. We kind of just see this going on from the perspective of the barkeep and Cassidy, who are doing their best to ignore it, which is impossible. The barkeep is saying, you know, he's worried they're going to tear the place apart. Cassidy is still sitting there trying to figure out what to do. You know, he wants to do the right thing and go help his friend. He makes a Star Wars reference about how he's Han Solo and looks up at the barkeep waiting for, you know, some back and forth there. And then asks the barkeep if he knows Star Wars, and the barkeep has the funniest answer. He's like, moving pictures? I don't know moving pictures. It would offend Allah. So, you know, here's the one man on the planet who doesn't know anything about Star Wars. It was really funny. But in the end, Cassidy decides not to leave with Tulip and Jesus, and their road trip begins. It's very short-lived, of course. The teaser for this episode did a number on us, thinking that we were going to get this big filler episode, Jesus and Tulip on a road trip, and that's really not what happened. So I liked that. But so the road trip begins. It's fun at first, like any road trip. They're hooping it up. They're having a blast, but all of a sudden it doesn't take long before we see that they are totally bored. Jesus is popping his lips and playing with he's playing with the visor. It's so funny.
Sun visor, yeah.
And Tulip's trying to spark up some conversation to cut the boredom, and she starts again telling Jesus how they're going to do whatever they want to do. And he's like, that's what?
Totally cool.
Yeah, she's like, you know, we could get high, we can watch TV, we could rob a bank. And that's where we just get this in this flashback or this really sequence of Jesus envisioning what it would be like to rob a bank. And of course, that's what they put in the trailer. So it was funny seeing it from this horrified reaction of Jesus can't even come to terms with the fact that he could do that. And finally decides that he just can't go through with it. And he has to go back to this conference. And so they turn around.
Oh, the bank robbing scene was hilarious to me. Just, you know, it's like people literally, Jesus Christ, Jesus, please help. He's got the shotgun. And yeah, he's just nervous. He accidentally shoots the man in the leg. And just.
So I heard on another podcast, there are some other great preacher podcasts out there. Hopefully you're listening to other ones too. If you're a fan of the show, I'll be happy to put them in the show notes or, you know, give them a shout out. But I was listening to another podcast where they said they were pretty sure that this man in the dream sequence that Jesus shoots at the bank is the same man that Featherstone shoots, because it's the same line. Like, the man says, I have to pee, when Featherstone is telling them all to be quiet and stand still. And then, you know, she turns around and stabs them or shoots them or whatever. And then this man is lying there on the floor saying to Jesus, I have to pee. I don't know that I necessarily caught that, but I thought that was a funny bit, if that isn't true. All right. So back at the Holy Grail Bar and Grail, the sex seems to have ended. Effendi is back at the bar next to Cassidy. The demon comes out, and Effendi pulls this ginormous machete from his jacket, turns around, and throws it through the demon's head. But not to worry, there's a flash of light, and she comes back to life. And then this never-ending fight is on, where they are just repeatedly, this almost becomes like background fodder, because they are just repeatedly killing each other and coming back to life. And what we've seen with the angels before, it's very much reminiscent of the Fior de Blanc fight scene. The yes. bodies just start piling up.
Yeah.
Because the flash of light brings them back, but their dead body is still lying right. on the ground. So it's hilarious. We're going to come back to that
Cassidy fight. Cassidy during this scene too, just sitting, you know, he just almost like rolls his eyes and sits there as it happens, because even that love seems to have a downside to it. So his acting during that scene is fantastic.
Yes, 100% agree. In our next scene, Jesse beats up a cop in order to steal the car. And before Eugene gets in the car, we do see him bend over and pick something up off screen. And I even said at the time, oh, I bet he's getting a gun. I thought, well, yeah, of course, he should have a gun. Why wouldn't he? You know, I didn't even think twice about it. Then we see a scene of the saint listening to a dead police officer's radio, and he's kind of hearing all the cars check in. And when it gets to Unit 14 checking in, it's clearly Jesse's voice. And so now the saint is back on their trail, knowing that he's after car 14. And then from the back of the police car, Eugene is sitting in the back for whatever reason, I guess to make it look more legitimate that they're driving around in a police car. But Eugene is still in shock and awe, and he says to Jesse, you came back and got me, and you apologized. And then he punctuates that with, it still wasn't enough. And then he shoots Jesse in the back. What did you make of that scene? I was like, oh my God.
I kind of saw it coming as it started, but even as it was going, I was like, surely he's not going to. And then I realized, oh, he's about to shoot Jesse. I kept wondering if this was where we were going to see him get like his eye shot out or mm-hmm. something. Cause I, you know, we talked about he eventually has an eye patch. So I kind of expected him almost to shoot him in the back of the head, or he'd turn around and shoot him in the face or something. But yeah, just you see a complete turn of Eugene here. And again, fantastic acting by Ian Coletti here as mm-hmm. Eugene to just show that change of emotion and that complete just dark turn for Arseface.
Right, because he can really only do the acting with his eyes, right?
Right.
I say face acting a lot, but he does amazing eye acting, because you can't see really any other expression in his face, but he's so good with going from this soft little boy, you know, somebody out there cares about me kind mm-hmm. of look, to then he just into sheer, still bitter anger all in his eyes. It's incredible.
It's really the first time there's been a couple of flashes where it seemed like he was going to be angry at Preacher in the past, but this is really the first time you really see just that like you said, you could see that change in his eyes, how dark he gets. And this is a different person we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Okay. So back in Masada, Jesus, apologizes to Tulip for not making it to Vegas, but he says, you know, it's just this conference. In 2000 years, it's the only thing they've asked me to do. So it's pretty important. This is funny. Jesus is hilarious. I'm really glad they found a way to weave him in and allow this actor to do something other than just Humperdoo, because he's really, really good. Tulip tells Jesus, look, I don't need you to say it. I just need you to know it. God is an asshole. So put a pin in that. I think Jesus will start to make that realization soon, hopefully. then Tulip stares at an unopened letter from Jesse and starts to head back. And then we get this great slow motion scene. Again, probably my other favorite scene from this episode. is The Joker and the Thief by Wolfmother is playing, and it's the slow walk of Cassidy and Tulip exiting the Holy Bar and Grail, while the demon and Effendi continue to fight in the background, and their fighting is in slow motion, and it's set to this great song, and it was just wonderful. Cassidy's got, I think Cassidy maybe is what he's wearing now is a burqa around his scarf around his neck, around his face to protect him from the sun. And so they get into Tulip's awesome muscle car and speed off toward Jesse. Of course, they're in the Middle East, so remember this. Their conversation is funny as they're driving off. They're talking about Australia, and Cassidy says, yeah, koalas have chlamydia out there. It's like a bloody slaughterhouse. And Tulip says, seriously? Cool. So we know what's coming next episode.
Yes, another crossover with Legion. Another crossover with Legion 2 as we get some chlamydia talk.
Right, exactly. Good one. A good callback. Okay, so final scene.
Is there any time when Joker and the Thief isn't an appropriate song?
You know, that's a good point. That's a good point. That song's great with everything, isn't it? I mean, I know it's played probably every sports arena now.
It should be played in every show, of every commercial. It's just, there's never, like, that song just, you hear that, dun, 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 like, you know something awesome is about to happen.
Of course. It's a great song. And that was awesome, seeing that set to that song. It was brilliant. All right. Jesus arrives to the Apocalypse Summit, where he finds Hitler sitting with Herr Star. He refuses to shake Hitler's hand. But then he's like, I know who you are. I'm not going to shake your hand. But as the Redeemer, I'll give you a hug. You know, he almost is like a game show host, goes in for the hug. And then they sit down and Jesus says, shall we begin? So now we know what this conference is all about. They're about to start the Apocalypse Summit. We see that on the literature that's sitting before them. And in the final scene, Jesse is crawling out of a crashed police car. He's injured from the shooting. He's grunting and moaning. Eugene gets out behind him and is still saying the apology wasn't enough. And the saint arrives. Dun, dun, dun. The end of episode 5. So this was another episode that did feel like more of getting the pieces into place, right? Not a whole, some funny moments, but very anticlimactic.
Right.
But, go ahead.
I was just saying, yeah, like you said, it kind of puts some characters together to really get ready for this next episode, which we get a lot of exposition going, you know, not boring exposition either, just a lot of clues and pieces of the puzzle start dropping here in episode 6.
Oh yeah, and by the end of episode 6, there, you know, shit is going down. So literally. So yeah, so let's move into it. So episode 6, entitled The Lost Apostle, which of course we know what that's a reference to. That's the place they're all headed, where everything converges. Right. And they actually say The Lost Apostle a couple times, and it's referenced a lot through this episode. So good title for this one. It opens with, oh my God, it's so hilarious. It's the story of Abraham. But in this iteration of Abraham, he's speaking with like a Bronx accent. Yeah. And he beats his wife. You know, he's not a good Abraham, but he is taking his son Isaiah out to the rock to sacrifice him because God told him to. But of course, at the last minute, God arrives and says, you don't have to do it. And we do see that this is actually something God is watching on a VHS tape from his trailer.
Was that Ike Barinholtz as Abraham?
You know, I did not know who it was. He reminded me of like a young Mark Wahlberg or.
Yeah. Well, that's he looks like a young Mark Wahlberg. He's the main guard in Suicide Squad, like the asshole.
Okay. Well, that movie's not memorable at all to me, so give me another point. But he was very good in this role. It was so funny, so hilarious. As God is watching it, though, he does rewind and watch over and over again the part where Abraham is down on his knees professing his love to God. Then we see God, of course, he's all hairy chested, you know, sitting with an open robe and some boxer shorts and disgusting hairy chest all hanging out. God is looking very unkempt. He is playing with a bunch of toys on his table. You know, these are all his Jesse artifacts. And then it does zoom in and we see one of them is a bomb. And then God picks up the phone, calls Hair Star, tells him to start phase two. And he does take just a moment to ask about Humperdew, and Star lies to him again. I love it. Star says, oh, yes, yeah, he's fine. He's gone to have his feet waxed. And then Star, you know, and then when they hang up the phone, we see Star tell Jesus and Hitler to start phase two, escalate. Phase two is escalate. As we see phase two start to unfold, the escalation is, of course, the heightening of the long-sought tensions between New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah.
This is what they're heightening. This is what they're escalating. As we see this SUV drop off that body of the man I called Mr. New Zealand because of the sash he was wearing, but really it's the New Zealand Prime Minister, and it's that, you know, the box that he was blown up in and then shipped out a few episodes back.
Right.
So the box is marked that it's from Australia. They open the box and it's just a bunch of bloody guts and crap inside. There's like a teddy bear in there though, but we do clearly see the sash, and they know too that this is their beloved Prime Minister. And so tensions are high between these two, you know, warring countries.
Yeah, I love the security guards when they see them, and I think they're like fucking Aussies. And then later we'll see the Australians do the same thing when they think New Zealand's coming for them. Just yeah, this made up almost near World War III esque tension between Australia and New Zealand. Who knew it would start there?
Very, very funny. So then we get the opening credits, and then after we come back from credits, there is this overhead scene of a cargo ship, and then it is kind of a long scene of Tulip's car racing through the streets of Melbourne. And I do want to shout out to Robbie Neely on Twitter. He's I am Yibor on Twitter. He sent us a funny tweet saying, I bet Tulip never stopped driving the whole time she was on that cargo ship. So that was really a funny observation because of the way we do get these scenes of her just raising hell through these streets. It was great visual, and it does pay an homage to the car, which is very significant in the comic. Her car is almost like a character of itself. Okay. So I do like that they gave us that, and they do give us just that snippet of explanation of how her car got from the Middle East to Australia with that one scene of the cargo ship. But good job, Robbie, for making something funny and also pointing out like, oh yeah, that's how her car got there. Duh. You know, so it's, you know, preposterous. Yes, but explainable, right?
Well, this is actually more explanation than later on the transition we get from how Air Star gets to Australia, because that might be my favorite character location transition ever.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Even better than how they were zipping around in Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this extended car scene, they end with Tulip and Cassidy charging into the Melbourne Police Department and demanding to see the person in charge. And we get this hilarious bit with this Australian lady coming out and giving this, I put my subtitles on, and even with the subtitles, I had no idea what the hell she was saying. But she's basically giving them the runaround about forms they have to fill out. And, you know, nobody just gets to see the commissioner. And then it was just hilarious the way Cassidy and Tulip turn it up at this moment and say, you know, look, they're the Americans. Damn it. They need to see the person in charge. And Cassidy just flashes his wallet. There's not even anything in it. He just flashes his wallet. Tulip, throws her gun down on the table. And they're like, we're the Americans. And Cassidy's using this fake accent. It is hilarious, but it works. And voila, they're in front of the commissioner.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I feel like there should have been another title sequence that popped up at that point, like a new spinoff, like The Americans. This is a 70s style buddy cop, you know, drama with Tulip and Cassidy as The Americans.
It was wonderful. I would watch that show 100%.
Oh, yeah.
So now they're in front of the commissioner again, trying to be very intimidating. Tulip throws everything off of his desk, you know, kind of swoops everything off his desk. She's leaning in, you know, where is he? Where is he? And finally the commissioner says, look, your man is dead. He was shot. And we actually have the killer locked up downstairs. So next we see Tulip interrogating Eugene. And again, very wonderful moment. Cassidy and the commissioner are kind of watching from behind the two-sided mirror. But Tulip is saying, look, you may have shot him, but when he's dead, I'll know. And then she gets in on this nice close-in shot and screams, do you understand? Because I know he is alive. And then we do get this little moment where Eugene says, well, I hope not, because if he is, he's worse off. Cut to the Saint extracting the bullet from Jesse's chest and then cauterizing the wound, which was so painful that it causes Jesse to pass out. And then it's the next morning, and the Saint just kind of kicks Jesse awake and tells him it's time to get moving. Jesse does try to use the word on him. I think this was kind of good exposition for us to see also that it doesn't work on him. And then, of course, Jesse just kind of shrugs it off, saying, oh, you know, I had to try. I had to test it.
Yeah.
And the Saint says, come on, we're going to kill God. I asked Sean at this point, remind me, why doesn't the word work on the Saint? And he said it's because the Saint doesn't have a soul. Is that the reason?
Right.
Is that what
he doesn't have at some point, Jesse, like, made him eat a soul or something at one point in the earlier seasons. And so that's why he was able to use the word for a little bit on him.
Right. Okay. Good. God, I'm going to have to go back. I'm going to rewatch the show. Clearly, I have forgotten a lot. All right. Meanwhile, at the summit, the greatest conversation is happening between Hitler and Jesus ever, arguing over deathbed conversions. You know, and they have like these, of course, they have the coffee shop there in Masada at their compound. So they have the Starbucks coffee cups sitting on the table, and they have, you know, in Sharpie marker, Hitler and Jesus written on them. It's such a great touch. But then they start to bargain for the homosexuals. Hitler's threatening to take back the homosexuals with this whole deathbed conversion thing. It greatly outweighs the numbers. And then, you know, Jesus is saying that maybe there just shouldn't be an apocalypse after all. And Herr Starr, who's kind of sitting above them as like a judge, he interferes and says there will indeed be an apocalypse. And in fact, it's already underway. There's been a spark to set the world on fire. So they need to get busy and decide which souls are going to heaven and which souls are going to hell. And I just love how Jesus and Hitler are both taking their commands from Herr Starr, not even questioning it for a minute.
Well, just that the apocalypse and everything is boiled down to basically an arbitration session between these two. And like you said, Herr Starr is kind of the judge, and these are the two lawyers from each side deciding how the assets are going to be broken up. You think of either, you know, a divorced couple deciding who gets what, or even a business that's being broken down and who gets what, you know, assets from the business or something. So I think it's funny this kind of professional way that they're just arguing over souls, you know, and who gets what and everything.
I agree. Back to Jesse and the Saint. They're still walking, and Jesse's trying to stall. And I love Jesse just as being defiant toward the Saint. Very, very devil may care attitude. First, he tells the Saint to eat shit. And the Saint said, you know, the Saint kind of turns around and says, I told you to come on. And Jesse says, right. And then I told you to eat shit. And he's just being like a bratty kid, right? And then Jesse says he knows the saint needs him alive. It's the only reason why he's still standing. He knows he needs him alive for some reason. So this is why he's acting, you know, this is the justification for why he's being so defiant. Then he tries to empathize with the saint. And the things he says are true. You know, he says, look, I'm angry at God too. He took my family away also. I even had a baby with Tulip long time ago in Dallas. And he, you know, he took that too. And I need some answers. I need to know why. So then he tries to appeal to the saint and says, leave God to me. But the saint just marches off and uses the only tool that he knows that he can to get Jesse to cooperate. And that is to just go on a killing spree. Because he knows that if he just starts killing people, Jesse will cooperate and follow him, right? So that's what he heads out to do. We do see some of his killing spree later on. Any more thoughts about this conversation between Jesse and the saint here?
Again, just I like this character pairing. Another character we haven't really seen. Well, we've seen them at odds, but now they are on the same side, whether he likes it or not.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they're at least going on the same path, and there's some more funny interactions with them in a little bit, you know, when we cut back to them. But again, another just unique pairing for the show.
It is a little bit of a plot hole, just a little bit, if I'm going to pick it apart. Like, why should Jesse give a damn if the saint kills God or not? Like, why can't Jesse say, look, I want to get my answers. I want to make him answer. And then you can do whatever the hell you want with him. You know, why should Jesse care if the saint wants to kill him? They should team up. They should be on the same side here, right?
Well, remember, Jesse doesn't want to kill God. He wants God to go back and do his job. And that, because he's worried if there's no God, there,
right,
the world might end. So I think that's Jesse, right, is still trying to get God to go back and basically take responsibility for everything.
He just wants to beat the shit out of God and put him in his place, as Jesse is wont to do.
Right.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. All right. So Tulip and Cassidy arrive to a house where they find an entire family hanged. I would presume this is by the saint. They speed on, discussing how they know they were close. They just missed him back at that house. And so they're driving very fast, but yet come to the end of the road, literally. And then we get a title card stating the Outback. So now they have to continue tracking him through the Outback, which I've never been, but I can imagine can be very challenging to probably track someone through. We do get a scene. We talked about this a little bit earlier. Vehicle is cut back to the heightened tensions between Australia and New Zealand. A vehicle is racing to, it's like a military vehicle, is racing into the Australian the Los Apostle National Park, which I'm sure exists. And it's carrying a large atomic bomb. And the guards at the gate believe these men to be New Zealanders, but doesn't matter what they're saying, they're killed straight away. And the vehicle charges through. So more to come on that bomb. Meanwhile, Jesse is still walking with the saint and uses another maneuver. This time he pretends to be tired and sits down on a rock. The saint comes over, grabs him by the collar, pulls him up. And when Jesse is this close to the saint, he uses this opportunity to grab both guns out of the saint's holsters and attempts to shoot him. But the guns are not loaded, so they don't work. And then in a very funny scene, Jesse takes both guns and tries to slap the saint across the face. He does like the whack, whack, you know, back and forth slap. And that doesn't affect the saint at all, which Jesse should know. I mean, for crying out loud, he got hit by that humongous ball from the ball and crane,
right,
that had to weigh thousands of pounds. A couple of slaps with some guns is not going to hurt him. But anyway.
Was this also where he's first walking, he said, you better watch out, I'm going to find a snake and tell it to bite
you. That's right. That's right. Because it does start with Jesse saying, I'm going to find a snake. Yeah. And then all the saint does, just again, like a parent scolding a bratty child, the saint just holds out his hands. Jesse has no other choice but to just give the guns back to him. And that is when the saint says, should have gone with the snake idea. Yeah. It was very funny, and they continued to walk on. So meanwhile, Tulip and Cassidy are now at a diner, and they're studying a map of the Outback, and they're trying to figure out where Jesse and the Saint could possibly be. And there is this funny bit about they're kind of having this argument about the roads or lack thereof on the map. You know, Cassidy says it's going to be hard to find when there aren't any roads, and Tulip gets very sassy with Cassidy and starts pointing out, you know, there's a road, you know. So anyway, this is kind of fillerish but funny. Then this is where some really great acting kicks in. Cassidy asks Tulip about the letter that Jesse gave her. And says, you know, maybe there's a clue in that letter about Jesse's whereabouts. And this is where we get 100% confirmation that Tulip actually has never, in fact, read the letter.
Right.
And so she says she doesn't need to read it. She knows what's in it already. You dumb bitch.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So she's just resigned herself to the fact that there's just no reason to read it. So Cassidy offers to read it, saying he'll skip over the personal stuff and just search for a clue. So Tulip gives it to him, and as he's reading it, we still don't know the contents of the letter, but again, Joseph Gilgan's face here just is full of emotion. He doesn't even make it through the whole letter, but he's clearly moved by it. He hands it back to her and says there are no clues in it. Just really, really, really good acting by both of them here. And I do hope we get to see what the hell's in this letter that could move Cassidy to almost to tears, right?
Yeah, you got to wonder if there's even maybe mention of Cassidy in it. You know, maybe he, because especially, you know, one of the last things is that he does kind of confirm that they slept together. So maybe he even tells her that she's better off with Cassidy than him or something.
Ooh, good point. Ooh, now I really hope we get to see what's in that letter. So then we get a very long, this is the scene that I really just felt like it took forever. There was no need for it. But Tulip walks outside, decides she needs some air outside of the diner. She hears terrible jazz music coming from a trailer out back. It takes her forever to approach this trailer and eventually walk inside and start looking around and even looking at whatever the little squealing animal is that he has in a cage under a covering, which she makes a disgusted face at. So I don't know, maybe we'll never know what animals God is keeping in there. Yeah,
because I think earlier, doesn't Airstar hear it? And he's like, is that a guinea pig?
Yeah.
And God's like, no. So I kind of was hoping it would show it because it made me think, I was hoping that there would be maybe a bunch of either extinct animals in there or just, like you said, almost abomination things that he created. But I almost wanted it to be like a dodo bird or something, you know, that would be it was something that people would see it and know that, okay, that animal's not supposed to be there, but God still has one type of thing. So,
yeah, or like you said, abominations, like messed up animals, things he's attempted to do that didn't quite succeed. And so
maybe it was a koala and with a bad case of chlamydia.
That's good. Anyway, so Tulip's looking around the trailer. She does see the postcard on the table with the lost apostle, and then she sees a dog suit hanging in the corner, and Eureka, suddenly now she is, you know, put two and two together, and she leaves the trailer to go off to tell Cassidy. And we do see God was watching all of this from the shadows. So he was in there the whole time. So she, even though she looked around and took her time to look at everything very carefully, she managed to never see him. Meanwhile, back at the diner, again, another filler scene, but very, very funny. The waitress comes and asks Cassidy if he'd like anything else. And he starts a list of all the drugs he'd like. Or anything really just to huff. You see, he's a drug addict and he needs something. It's been a while since he's had anything. And the waitress, of course, is named Sheila. And so he's like, so Sheila, if you've got anything like that, I'll gladly take that. Otherwise, just the check. And her face is so deadpan. Like she's just been waiting to all, listening to all of his requests so patiently. And she very plainly tells him that she thinks there's some fire retardant out back. So the next scene we see, Cassidy's nose is all bloody. He's sitting out back huffing fire retardant. Tulip approaches him and even asks him what he's doing and what he's huffing. And he says fire retardant. And she's just like, oh, you know, just thinks nothing of it. And then she tells Cassidy she knows where Jesse is going. He's going to meet God. She shows him the postcard of the lost apostle. And then as they take off to leave to start heading toward it, you hear her say, I hope there's roads. And Cassidy says, we don't need no stinking roads.
Yeah, so I thought about this earlier in the episode and even last episode too, but have you noticed that the past couple episodes, they're just being really loose with like how exposed to the sun Cassidy can be?
Yes. Well, did he have his burka on while he was huffing?
I mean, even when he walks out of the Holy Grail and bar in the last episode, he's got it on, but his face isn't like covered. And when he's in the car, you know, there's still sunlight everywhere.
Yeah.
Not that it's a big, you know, kind of nit, but still, it kind of makes me laugh that they're kind of just like, whatever.
they're playing fast and loose of what defines direct sunlight, right? That's okay. I can deal. Okay, so next we see Hairstar. He gets the phone call and triumphantly stands up and announces he's going to Australia. And we get the NXS New Sensation song as Hairstar's packing and heading out of Masada. And we get just this brief glimpse as he's walking by the coffee bistro, that little coffee bistro inside Masada. And who do we see in a disguise working as a barista, but none other than Featherstone herself? It's our only glimpse of her this whole episode. Great disguise, too. It's like, she's got a beard, but it's like she's wearing the wig from when she was Jenny. you can't really, is it a woman with a beard? She's meant to look like a man. It's a funny disguise.
Really. Yeah, Airstar also runs into Hoover too and lets him know that soon he's going to be beautiful again.
Yes, that's right. Because, you know, he thinks God has promised to restore his great looks. And then Hoover too just has no reaction to it.
He's like, sounds great, sir. Yeah.
So funny. So funny. All right. So now the end scenes are upon us. Tulip and Cassidy have somehow, this got very yada yada over, but they've somehow gotten their hands on a plane, and Jesse is completely ready for them, completely aware they're coming in behind him, and they swoop in behind him and the Saint is completely unaware, and they manage to spray a bunch of red dye or something out of the plane just long enough to distract the Saint so he can't see them as they snatch up Jesse and fly away. So hooray, the gang is all back together again. I was just, even the briefest moment of these three together, oh, I have missed it. And such a perfect reunion, punctuated with the string of them saying hey to one another on the plane. So they're sitting there on the plane. Tulip's flying it. Let me paint the picture. Tulip's flying it. Cassidy, who is still high from the fire retardant, is just kind of sitting there. Jesse is sitting, and Cassidy's wearing headphones. It's a very loud, like, cargo plane, right? So Cassidy's wearing headphones. Jesse turns to him and just says, hey. And this is their reunion, right? And Cassidy can't hear him, so he kind of removes one of the headphones from his ear and like leans in, and Jesse says, hey, again. And Cassidy says, oh, hey, he, like, just says, hey, back. And then Jesse leans forward like he's speaking to Tulip and says, hey, to her. Whether she hears him or not, she ignores him. So then Jesse pulls one of the headphones away from Cassidy's ear and speaks into it saying, hey, to Tulip, to which she continues to ignore him. And there's this awkward pause. And then Cassidy turns to Jesse and said, she says, hey. And that's the extent of their conversation. It was hilarious. Now, and then we do see a little smile kind of creep in on Tulip's face. It's just great to see them all back together again. But this string of Hayes, it was very who's on first. You know, it was that kind of comedic timing. Right. I love that kind of shit. We get a quick scene of the Grail Men, final scene with this bomb. The Grail Men are unloading just out in plain daylight. They're behind a rock. Yeah. They're unloading the atomic bomb. An unsuspecting hiker rounds the corner, starts asking too many questions, and one of the men just shoots him in the face, and they just turn around and continue about their work. And this is where he's like, because they say, the Grail Men tell him they're from New Zealand, and the man, he's the hiker. I mean, they're there with a huge bomb, and the hiker doesn't think anything about getting the hell out of there. He's just like, I know Kiwis when I see them, and you're not Kiwis. I'm not even going to attempt to do the accent, but it was hilarious.
It reminded me of the Australian that's there when the Saint and Eugene shoot through the earth and pop out in Australia. Just he's not surprised. He's just like, did you just come out of that hole? I would have thought that had been impossible, and just get shot in the face, you know. But just, it's like they're not surprised. They're just kind of like interested in what's going on. Like, what are you guys doing there? You got a bomb there?
Going to show what peace-minded countries these really are. So the setting this heightened tension between them is just, it's brilliant. It's very funny. Great writing. Great writing. All right. So this is where Hairstar is suddenly in Australia. He rocketed there.
He runs into the scene as if he just left like this, the set of Masada, ran across the studio and ran into the set in Australia.
Right. He got there so fast.
It's completely intentional to make it look like that, I think, but that made me laugh. He just, it literally looks like he's like out of breath. Like he just ran there as fast as he could.
Hilarious. So he's suddenly speaking with God. God is at the Lost Apostle Rock. Hairstar runs in, and Star says, you know, assures God that phase two is underway. And God starts laughing again about, you know, how Hairstar wants to, what's it again? What is it you want to do to Jesse? And Star's like, yeah, I want to carve the vagina into Jesse's head. And this is where Star very delicately reminds God that he was promised to have his looks restored as well, right? He says, you know, my looks were always a calling card for me. And I do think it's funny that during this exchange, God is calling him Klaus, like the way Jesse always refers to Hairstar.
Mm-hmm.
And Hairstar once again lies to him about Humperdew, to which God just turns and stares at him so long that Hairstar realizes that God's known all along that Star's been lying to him. So, and he knows now for sure that God knows that Humperdew is lost. So he starts to assure God, don't worry, we will find him. And God says that, I love God's line. He says, I hope so, because God, I love that kid. I like how he says his own name, you know, like
right
in an exclamation. Then he calls for the Canis Lupus Dingo to come charging in. And that dog wastes no time, immediately has Hairstar on the ground and begins ripping apart his genitals. And God says in a booming voice, don't ever cross me again. Now, this is horrifying. It does happen in the comics. It happens with just a dog in the comics. So I love that it's a dingo, because they're in Australia. It's so funny. The maiming of Hairstar is a gag throughout the whole comic, you know, just this continuing, you know, so the ear, his balls, you know, and I do believe there's more to come.
Yeah.
So, anyway, any more thoughts about this scene?
You almost feel bad for him, but then you don't.
That's exactly right. It's exactly right. And I love that he was so giddy about thinking God was going to give him his looks back. And now he's, you know, oh, I think we're really in for more with Hairstar. You know what I was going to say with the thing about Jesse and the eye patch and how they've been playing fast and loose with these trailers and teasers for this show. I'm wondering if they did that one scene with Jesse for the eye patch strictly for the trailer, just to throw people off the set, just to get comic book readers waiting for this moment, you know, for Jesse to lose his eye like he does in the comic. But I'm starting to think they're not going to do it. So, which I'm okay with. I mean, Dominic Cooper is such a handsome man. Let's keep him as just as handsome as possible throughout the whole show. All right. Final scene. And boy, it's a hard one. Jesse and Cassidy start having a discussion and realize that, is this where they start to discuss how when he meets God, he wants him to answer for the Big Lebowski? Is this where Cassidy brings it up again? So I love this three beat really throughout the whole season. I think this is the third time we've heard mention of Cassidy's disdain for the Big Lebowski, of which I completely disagree with, 100% disagree with. But it was funny where he says, when you meet him, make sure you get the answers about the Big Lebowski. And then he says, you know, how, and then Jesse says, well, you know, how'd you even know where to find me anyway? And Cassidy says, oh, we found the postcard in God's trailer. And that's when these two blockheads realize they're moving into a trap. And they're very close. Tulip says, there's your rock, there's your God. So just as they are about to swoop in and have the realization they're moving into a trap and start to say, fly away, it's a trap. God claps his hands and the atomic bomb goes off and the plane is completely rocked and is definitely going down and falling apart on its way down. Jesse falls out of the plane after one of the doors flies off and Cassidy is holding on to his arm, desperately trying to hold on to him, even though his arm is burning up in the sun, 100%. And Jesse is begging him to let go of him, and Cassidy won't let go of him. And finally, Jesse uses the word to force Cassidy to let go. And this is where we do see the scene of Jesse falling to his death. It's the scene we saw from episode one. Everything really starts to go into slow motion. We see Tulip crying in the plane. And the final scene is Jesse hitting the ground. Very, very dead. The end.
we make it back to the beginning of the season. So yeah. We're kind of caught up at that point.
Only took six episodes to get there.
And I did like how Jesse realizes how, like, he doesn't even think about how they found him until right when it's too late. You know, and it puts it all together. I'm guessing Air Star was transported back to Masada before the bomb went off, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point, because that bomb would have definitely taken care of not only the dingo, but Air Star as well. So, yeah. Right. So, in the trailer, did you see the trailer for the next time on?
Yes.
It is. I think it's assured that Jesse is dead here. We got the foreshadowing earlier in the episode with Tulip saying, I'll know when Jesse's dead. And then at the end of this episode, Jesse looks very dead and Tulip is clearly crying and upset and knows Jesse's dead. And in the trailer, it definitely looks like Jesse is in heaven. And we get the return of Fiore and DeBlanc. I'm so excited to see these two again. And looks like they are definitely wanting possibly Jesse to take over in heaven. Unclear. It doesn't show much, but definitely Jesse is in heaven. So something's got to happen. I mean, if they could bring Tulip back to life in season three, they can bring Jesse back to life in season four. Very doable on this show, right?
Yeah, I definitely see this as a one-off episode where almost the entire thing takes place with just Jesse in heaven. It wouldn't surprise me if it's almost entirely set there. And I do like that we're seeing heaven since we saw hell so much in season two. So now we can finally see heaven, how they're going to depict that. I'm sure it's going to be hilarious or insane, one of the two. But yeah, he'll get sent back somehow.
So we have four episodes to go. I do think, yes, this next episode will be that, but I also think it'll be the hotel scene with Tulip and because their plane is going down, right? So Tulip and Cassidy are going to have to hole up in a hotel room. This is where Tulip is going to be extremely depressed and distraught. So this is where she's going to be drinking all that beer. So this could be the first kiss between Tulip and Cassidy. Like, we're going to see that again. Could lead to more than just kissing.
Yeah. I also thought, I thought about that first scene with them. I do remember that while this is all going on, you hear all this chaos going on. So I'm assuming the angel and the demon are still going to be fighting while this scene's taking place.
Well, you think they go all the way back to Masada? I would think it's just the chaos going on around them in Australia because that bomb has gone off.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I just, for some reason, I always thought it was the same bedroom that was at the Holy Bar and Grail.
Looks like it's probably the same set, but
and that would be funny if they go back and the angel and demon are still just in there fight. Like, it's just if they just for 3 days have been just piling bodies up.
If we get another scene of that cargo ship, and then all of a sudden they're just back in the
yeah.
I think they're gonna have to stay in Australia at this point, but. I mean, it would be ridiculous if they are back. I guess anything's possible.
Yeah. But maybe it'll be a war going on between the Aussies and the Kiwis that we hear.
Because that is what they say. You hear that out there. It sounds like the end of the world. I'm going to go back and try to watch that scene again because I'm trying to recall if the letter is on the nightstand open. Mm. I think it is. So I do think I think we're going to see the contents of the letter in the next episode. We're going to see whatever it takes to get Jesse back to life. And we're definitely going to see something going down between Tulip and Cassidy. That's fine for that episode. And then we'll have three to go. Now, what I do think is that somehow this angel and demon is going to be like, Chekhov's gun, right? We're going to, just when we've kind of forgotten about them, I think they're going to kind of be the ones that maybe swoop in and somehow help Jesse. At this point, it's become such a battle royale. It's just everybody out to get everybody. So it's really no clear cut, so the saint wants to kill God. Jesse wants to make God go back to work. I think somehow Effendi and this demon lover are going to come back in it and somehow to help their son. And that's when we're going to get the reveal that they're the parents of Genesis. I do think that somehow the saint and Jesse are going to have to take each other's side. They're going to have to pair up. I don't know. Definitely God is going to go down. I do feel strongly that God is going to be taken down.
Yeah, I think Jesus ends up being like the new God. You know, like he actually will become the true Messiah. Because I think that would be a funny play on the showrunners too, to where at the end it's like a Jesus saves, spin-off or spin the way they pull that. But I can see him being the person that really helps everything. Surely Humperdew is going to let everybody down or something. we're going to see Humperdew back at some point.
I almost think Humperdew, and I may have heard this theory. Or seen it out on Twitter, but I almost thinking, so I'm not saying this is 100% an original thought, but this is something I've been persuaded to believe. Not Humperdew, excuse me, Eugene. I almost think that Eugene could end up having Genesis inside of him, because now he's got that perfect little balance of good and evil now that he has attempted murder, right? I think somehow Jesse's going to lose Genesis, and where's Genesis going to go? He's got to find another host where he can live in harmony. And I think that's somehow going to be Eugene's reward, because see, Eugene also can't ever use it because no one can understand what the hell he's saying.
That would be funny. Yeah.
And I do think that, I don't know. So if they kill God, who is going to become the new ruler of heaven? right? Could be the saint, could be Jesus.
Hitler, they just really go for it and put Hitler in charge of him.
So what is going to be the fate of Hitler? Now, Hitler maybe could get the go count sand for the rest of your life. You know, the treatment that Hoover gets in the comic book. Something funny. There's still got to be something funny to come with Hitler. And there still has to be a finality with the Humperdoo and all the Humperdoo clones. So they've got to wrap that up too. So I guess these aren't really predictions, as just things that I still see are looming out there that they still have to take care of.
Humperdoo and the clones end up with like a Vegas show that they just do like soft shoe routines and stuff. Yes. That would be nice.
That would be wonderful.
Instead of Vegas showgirls, it's Vegas show Humperdoos.
How will the love triangle be resolved between Jesse and Tulip and Cassidy? Or will they all three live?
I don't know. I think one of them's, someone's got to die. Someone's got to die.
I don't want to bring my comic, I don't want to bring my comic knowledge in on this. But I think they're all three going to be alive by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may all three have to go through a death and rebirth. We've already seen Tulip die and be reborn or come back to life. I guess Cassidy is the undead, so he's, you know, the embodiment of that already. So Jesse is dead now. I don't think he can possibly stay dead. I really don't. No. So I don't know that we're going to see a death for any of the three of them.
Yeah, I could also see Cassidy and Tulip realizing that although they think that they love each other, not really, you know, I think what Tulip and Jesse has is deeper.
Yeah, I agree. Which I don't like thinking about Cassidy having his heart broken. So I can see room for a real Cassidy death, a definitive Cassidy death. But I just can't see where that would leave Tulip and Jesse in a happy place to rekindle their relationship. It's a lot of ground to cover with only four episodes left, Dean. It's a lot.
Well, hey, just think about where we were with only two or three episodes left of Legion. And
it's true.
They pulled it off, so.
Well, my friend, we have once again put another episode of Mike TV in the books. We are going to try very hard to get back on a week-to-week schedule. If not, you know, we'll definitely finish up Preacher. We've got American Horror Story coming. They've announced a release date for Watchmen. I know we will cover that week to week. I think it starts October 20th. Anyway, you can Google that and find that. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited for Watchmen. I can't wait. I'm almost just not even interested in any other shows until that. So we'll see how American Horror Story coverage goes. We might not do that week to week. We might double up some episodes there too, just depending on how it goes. So anyway, in the meantime, follow us on Twitter at MikeTV1. And Dean, give your Twitter handle also, please.
Find me on Twitter at Rockdale_Tiger. Also find us both participating and lurking around the Radio Labyrinth Facebook fan group, The Radio Shack.
Yes. There's some fun stuff going on over there. And there's some pictures from the live event on the Radio Shack page. And I'm sure we'll get them up on the website soon, too. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Keep watching Preacher. We will talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.